This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, and podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Tonight, our guest is Dr. Kath Dickinson from Otago University, and she's a professor at the Botany Department, and our show associated with Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. Welcome. Now we're going to start off with our number of the week, which is 20 million. And that is the number of feral cats living in Australia, and they're wreaking extinction-level havoc on the native fauna of Australia. In a bold experiment, ecologists in Australia want to remodel a dingo-proof fence that stretches from eastern Queensland to the South Australian coastline. This fence is more than 5,500 kilometres long and was originally constructed in the 1880s to keep out rabbits. It is, in fact, the longest fence in the world. And altering the fence's boundary would enable dingoes to enter the Sturt National Park in New South Wales, allowing scientists to assess whether dingoes, long reviled by many people as a dangerous to livestock and even humans, could in fact act as the saviours for threatened native animals. It is thought that dingoes would deter both the feral cats and foxes from predating on native fauna, and perhaps even prey on the cats themselves. So supporters point out how keystone apex predators can have wide-ranging and unpredicted benefits in ecosystems. Indeed, the introduction of the wolf into Yellowstone Park in the US had wide-ranging and unpredicted benefits, including altering the very geography of the park. The river system was altered, and I can only recommend George Monbiot's TED Talk about this for further details. Just check that out on TED Talks, George Monbiot and Yellowstone Park, and you'll find out all about how, what the wolves did. It was quite incredible. So the scientists hope that the reintroduction of a dingo will help save endangered native species. And let's hope that's the case. So that's my number of the week, which is 20 million feral cats. And did you have a thought for the week, Sam?
I do have a thought for the week. This is an interesting week for me because it's the first week of the student projects that I run in the Bachelor of Information Technology. And one of the ones that's got me particularly excited is we're going to try and copy a method that was developed at the University of Lancaster for the Isle of Tiree. They call it speed play for various reasons. We did a talk with Maria Angela Ferrario about this. We're calling it technology-mediated community engagement, which is not quite as exciting as what she was calling it. And what we're dubbing it as is IT as a performance. So what we're trying to do is to do some very rapid prototype development with the community to engage people in a particular topic. We haven't decided the topic yet. We want to trial the method. So it's not about the production of these artifacts. It's more about what can we do to engage people, use this to get people excited about different things. So I shall keep you posted on that one.
Well, that sounds pretty exciting. So we're just going to have a quick word from our sponsor.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
So our guest tonight is Professor Kath Dickinson. She did her BSc Honours degree in Sheffield in the UK and her PhD in Australia. And Kath is principally interested in plant-animal interactions and the ecology thereof. Welcome to our show, Kath.
Oh, thank you, Shane. Now, it's lovely to be here.
Now, that's a lovely English accent you have there. So where are you from? Are you from Sheffield originally? Or?
No. I grew up in the northeast of England in Newcastle upon Tyne.
A bit further north,
about 50 or 60 miles south of the Scottish border.
And so what led you to do your honours degree in Sheffield. What was your motivation there?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Several things. One is a number of my friends at school were going to that particular part of the country, but it was a very good geography programme at Sheffield, which was my honours degree was in geography. But what really swung it was the proximity of the Peak District National Park, which you could get to by bus. And that's really what ended up swinging it.
So what was it? What created this love for the Peak District? Is it?
Well, but more importantly, what created the love for BSc Honours in Geography?
Ah, yes. Well. Well, if I just backtrack a little bit, I mean, often it comes back down to teachers. And at school I went to, two amazing geography teachers who just thought geography was, the bee's knees, and I'll come back to bees perhaps later. But also is that the curriculum that I came through with at school was substantially more narrower than school kids have available to them today. And in the system I came through in England, you had to make choices, quite considerable choices at the age of 14 as to what you might do for O-level, and then considerable choices at the age of 15, 16 as to what you would do at A-level. At the age of 14, I thought I wanted to do certain things, chose particular A-levels, and I chose to do, I thought at that point I wanted to do geophysics and glaciology. I loved the mountains. So I did physics and mathematics and geography. And then I discovered ecology just by doing things from outside of school, actually. I'd never heard of ecology before that. But we can talk about that a bit more if we want to. But in terms of what it was about ecology, but what it meant was that geography, with the breadth of geography, can lead you in multiple directions. It's a broad degree, which I look back now and I'm very, very glad I did that. Ecology wasn't really available in the UK at the time. Otherwise, I might have done that. But it gave me a very, very, very good grounding in physical geography and human geography. And as I say, I'm very grateful for that.
So is that why you went to Australia? What brought you to Australia?
No. Okay, so I completed in the UK system at the time. It's a three-year honours degree. It's quite a pressure cooker. At the time, I looked back and wished I'd taken a gap year after school, but I hadn't. So I decided to do a gap year after finishing the honours degree. And so I got a working holiday visa, and one of my brothers was living in Australia at the time, and set off to Australia with the broad goal of getting experience in ecology, practical experience in ecology and conservation, and preferably, to be paid. But I was willing to do it voluntarily and, do whatever else just to get some income. And so I never set out to do a PhD. I didn't think I was set up for academia, to be quite honest. I didn't really relate to the academic system in the UK. It's rather different to the more egalitarian approach in Australia and New Zealand. And but it was during that year that just the particular opportunities that came along, I was offered a PhD position.
So I'm really interested in how you got into ecology, because you said that geography wasn't... ecology wasn't a thing. You could do geography, but it kind of led into ecology. How did geography lead to ecology, and how did you get that interest?
Okay.
Because you go to Australia to do it.
Yes. Well, if I can backtrack a little bit, because it was at school where I was doing geography, which I enjoyed very much with very enthusiastic teachers. But I had two things outside of school. One, I, at the age of 16, got very much involved with an exploration society, and I was able to, as a 16-year-old, to go and get very excellent training in safety in the mountains, outdoors. It started off in the Lake District, and then at the age of 17, I was able to go and work with a whole spectrum of people from a whole range of ages between 17 and 25, from a whole set of backgrounds, to go and work in Iceland with the National Parks organisation in Iceland. And that led to I'd been to Iceland twice before going to university, and then carried on going another three times. But that also led to, whilst I was at university, doing the honours dissertation at the time in my third year, and the same opportunity with this same organisation, I went with a group of eight from the UK who had chosen to go to Kenya, to work with the Nairobi Museum, Natural History Museum, and over and working with the Kenyan Exploration Society. And that, of course, was my first experience of Africa. And that was, if I look back now, a life-changing experience. And certainly brought in the social and the natural sciences in my mind, which, I mean, as we talk through, I'll refer back to that grounding that I had in the social and the natural sciences. Since then, most of the grounding has carried on in the natural sciences, but I'm coming back to that blend again in the last few years.
That must have been a very exciting time for you when you were young to go to, I mean, to Iceland and Africa. You know, it was an amazing
opportunity.
Absolutely
exciting now.
Yeah. Very exciting. And actually what was very, very interesting was that at the time, the excitement in the subject was outside of the education system. So there was an early appreciation from my point of view in terms of sitting in a lecture theatre and a laboratory where it was much more regimented, as opposed to that excitement of what ecology really was like in terms of doing subjects of relevance. And I mean, my honours dissertation was looking at the effects of shifting agricultural systems on changing soil regimes and the links between plants and soils at that point, and people and how and why they were changing the length of time that areas of land were left fallow, and what the economic pressures and the population pressures were leading them to do this, even though they knew that it wasn't necessarily a sustainable practice. So early lessons, and we didn't really use the word sustainable in the sustainability sense now, but certainly the concept of sustainability was very well entrenched.
So what year was this?
Oh, gosh, no.
Sorry.
So that's okay. No, 1979. Yeah, most might be before many listeners perhaps were. Anyway, a long time ago now.
So but well after ecology was established as a science, particularly
well,
in the US.
Absolutely, yes. Ecology was established as science before then, but in the UK system in 1977 when I started my BSc honours degree, it was an embryonic degree at the University of East Anglia. And other than that...
The people we would now recognise as ecologists were coming out of botany?
Coming out of botany, geography, zoology, for the most part, I would say. The recognised sort of subject disciplines up until that point, until we started... The higher education system, I guess, started to broaden out a bit in the last 20 years, perhaps.
So tell us what ecology is as a science.
Well, I mean, the definition is, as I'm sure you're aware, Sam, I mean, we like to talk about the study of interactions. For me, what that also encapsulates is that ecology is complex science, but that does not mean that we can't try to understand it. For me, also, ecology... is inclusive of people, and of course that reflects the geography route that I've come to ecology. Coming back to your question, Shane, as to how geography actually at Sheffield got me into ecology, was that I had to wait to third year to actually do the specialist third year papers, and I did plant ecology as a specialist subject. I did micrometeorology. I did coastal geomorphology. And I forget which, it might have been fluvial geomorphology. So what it meant, what I look back on now, is actually that breadth of putting plants in the context of the physical as well as the biological environment. And I'm very grateful for having that grounding.
So you talk about the ecology of communities, and that's one of your 200-level papers is
yes.
Ecology of community and
ecosystems. Yes.
So what's the ecology of a community? I mean, because that's you're basically tying communities into nature, which is again, one of those things I'm kind of trying to tease out in this this series, you know, series of discussions.
If we look at plants, say, and let's just say plant, we can talk about plant ecology, and we can look at a single species, say, and we might term that orticology, if you like. It's focusing on a single species and understanding that. If we want to look at the whole assemblage of that particular species, we want to try and understand the population of that species. When we're trying to understand how a whole range of individual plants and populations interact, we talk about the community. Now, if we then go into the ecology of the community and we don't specify it as to be plants, then we want to understand how the plants and the animals interact. If we then go and talk about the ecosystem, we want to understand how the plants and animals interact in relation to the environment of which they are a part. So it's sort of like a, we'll call it in the teaching of ecology, levels of organisation, if you like. You start from the individual, you go to the population, you go to the community, and you go to the ecosystem.
But those are kind of separate levels of understanding. Mm. I mean, I was kind of really interested in that, the idea of the green, you know, from complex systems theory, the idea of the green slime mold, that you could understand everything about green slime, which you can, as an individual celled organism, but you can't predict its behavior when it becomes stressed and becomes this multicellular organism, which you can't predict that because it doesn't seem to differ that much from any other.
That's a really interesting point, Shane. I mean, if we come back to that word complexity, and we think about the tendency, maybe that it's easier to think in a linear way. But if we start to think of things in a non-linear way, then we start to think of whether it's the mold or now, I was thinking about some analogies on the way here. If we think about a two-dimensional spider's web, it's highly complex. You can see multiple threads in that spider's web. It's incredibly strong. Until it's very strong in particular directions, until a human comes along, it doesn't have to be a human, and just goes straight through it, slashes it. And suddenly you've got all that work very quickly disassembled. So that community that spider's web, we could say, is the community of interactions and relationships. Now, if we're looking at what might disrupt that community, is that you can have very sudden disruptions or you can have slow disruptions. And in ecology, we talk about slow variables and fast variables. I don't know whether that helps in terms of if we look at the particularly when we talk about ecosystems, there aren't any boundaries, for example, and if we're looking at it in the sense of trying to understand the concept, it can be quite difficult until we start to get some analogies, in which case we can say whether we're talking at the scale of a tree or a forest or at the country level or, you know, an ocean level.
Is it because I suppose when you're looking at the ecosystem, is it more looking at how the individual actors or agents in the system interact with each other rather than the real detail of those agents? Are you looking at the way they interact, or are you looking at, you know, the detail of a plant or how it exists, or is it both? And how do you, and those are very different ways of thinking, aren't
absolutely
they?
Well, if you look at the community of ecologists, the people working in ecology, you will have folk who are looking at the detail. And if you can imagine, say, that we look at the detail and someone's interested in what's the relationship between the soil and above ground, now there's a lot going on in the soil. Someone like myself works at a much broader scale. So my interests might lie at the national scale, or it might be across latitudes, looking at relationships between analogues across hemispheres, for example. So it's not one size fit all in terms of the study of ecology.
And how has the IT revolution, has that helped being able to map out these obviously incredibly detailed and incredibly complicated relationships? And Has it influenced the way people have been thinking about things, how these things work out?
That's a very good question, because, in fact, I think in the last few years there's somewhat of a revolution occurring. Since I did my honours degree, the computer capacity has gone from dealing in tens of kilobytes through megabytes, through gigabytes, to terabytes and beyond. So the capacity of some of my colleagues who are now dealing with multiple terabytes of data and able to do some really sophisticated modelling with some very, very powerful computer networks, not just from New Zealand but tapping in elsewhere in the world, is that our ability to actually deal with massive data sets and model those data sets to enable some predictive modelling, that capacity is increasing on a yearly basis now, I'd have to say. And if you compare what was able to be done 20, 30 years ago, then the difference is substantial.
Do you still have to get your feet wet?
Do I still have to get
them? No, those modellers, do they still have to?
It depends on the modeller. I mean, I could say a modeller... Models are, you can have the most sophisticated model, but there's the old adage, rubbish in, rubbish out. So it's always a good idea to be very well grounded in getting your feet wet and understanding how accurate the data is that you're using in the first place. I mean, it could be if you're accessing a data set that was collected 10 or 20 years ago by somebody else, that data actually was collected in a fairly broad kind of way because of the nature of the job at the time. But if you then try and use that data to answer and predict and model at a very detailed level, then you could be getting some spurious results coming out of it. So the best modellers, I think, are very well grounded and getting their feet wet, we might say, very well grounded in natural history, perhaps. Yeah.
And you? Do you?
I'm not a modeller in that sense. But in terms of, do I get out my feet wet? Not as much as I once did, but I think it pays to actually keep getting your hands dirty and getting your feet wet to keep yourself grounded. Yeah.
You've talked about, in other words, you've talked about reduction versus systems type thinking. Do you have to do both, or is it mostly systems? Where do you see the lines on those things?
Again, if we're looking at ecologists, the spectrum of ecologists, as I said, people will occupy the space across from highly reductionist through to broad spectrum thinkers. I think as a field, and it's a bit like geography really, the field tends to attract people who are able or attracted to complex thinking, can think in an interactive way, and often can think at the broad scale, and often multitask in that sense because of having to think about things in a non-linear fashion, if you like.
We've been talking about ecological science, and of course the other use of the word ecology is the greenie ecologists.
Right.
How do those two sit together?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, of course, you've got another factor in amongst that, and that's the media, and how the media might portray the greenies. There's elements amongst the greenies, which you might describe as fringe elements, and elements about those who are paraphrased as greenies that would come into some who describe themselves as ecologists. In some ways, it depends on whether it's the word term greenie is being used to try and devalue the message which is coming across and on what basis that message is underpinned by good science. So, you know, it's about this melding of how the message is treated.
You use the term ecology and conservation.
I'm
not sure if you're using those two things interchangeably or are they separate things?
I wouldn't use them interchangeably. because there's some ecologists who are not conservation biologists. They work in different areas and are extremely good at the study of interactions, if you like. And the word ecology, of course, is being applied in a whole range of places. The ecology of health, for example. So the term ecology is being taken as a sense of understanding interactions with respect to can we discern some patterns in amongst, can we discern some sense out of it? And if we can't, to what extent? I mean, there's been a discussion in the last 5-10 years or so as to whether it's chaotic. I mean, looking at chaos theory, for example, is it all chaotic and really there aren't any patterns that are readily discernible?
So are there some big things that everybody across the community should, the people community, should know about ecology or plant ecology? Are there some fundamentals that we should say, well, clearly everybody needs to know this?
Right. Well, I mean, it would be interesting your ideas on this too, Sam, but the essence of ecology is it's all around us. And one of the research areas that I'm involved with, for example, at the moment we're revisiting it, is a study of the gardens in Dunedin City. And not everybody, of course, has a garden, but there's the opportunity to have window boxes or get a bucket with some soil in it and produce and get some plant pots. So that is ecology at a small scale, interactions, and ultimately it can involve growing your own food, obviously, or looking at some beautiful flowers. The beautiful flowers may attract some really interesting insects, for example, pollinators. That's ecology. You're looking at the ecology of plant invertebrate interactions then. Now, that's a insect coming to pollinate a beautiful flower. So that's something that we have in the world around us. Ecology is around us all the time.
So we've had this idea since humanism and Christianity and had this idea that humanity is separate from nature, and it seems to be quite pervasive still in society. Obviously ecology is saying, well, no, we're not. Is that one of the key ideas? That do people struggle with that concept that we're still separate? Because I remember at school having arguments that we weren't animal people. Our teacher turned around and said, humans aren't animals. We're not animals. We are. So people still thought we weren't animals when I was growing up.
Oh, yeah, well, still do. I mean, I think most days you'll hear on the news or in one form or another where the expression will be people and animals. And, of course, as you say, Shane, people are animals. I must say, one of the things I noticed when coming from my background in the UK to this part of the world was that the ecology route that I'd come to, where people were part of the science, to come to a situation where people were, in terms of the science, were being viewed as sort of separate from the system. And, the interesting pathway in Australia and New Zealand as to how that has come about, or did come about. And if we look at, there's analogues in the US, of course, with the various pathways to developing protection of certain land areas and wilderness and such like. But whether people are directly part of a system or indirectly part of a system, I mean, even in the remotest parts of Antarctica, the evidence suggests these days that people have an indirect influence.
Is it perhaps because in Europe and the UK, there's such a long history of people and habitation that even the things that we see are natural are clearly co-evolved systems, whereas the national park things in the New World are quite separate from where people are?
Well, I think it reflects that, yeah, the probably it reflects the sort of colonisation history. Because if we go and look at the Australia, at the minimum, the Aboriginal people in Australia have been there 50,000 years, and the evidence suggests longer than that. And their relationship with the land is so entirely integrated. And of course, if we look at the holistic view, or the Maori holistic view, mountains to the sea approach to the New Zealand environment. And of course, ecologists, the botany department we have, for example, we talk about working from the mountains to the sea with that message of integration and you know, for the land and the fresh water and the marine and the continuity of that.
So is there a philosophical shift now in the sciences between that Cartesian ideal of, you know, humanity being separate from nature and different from it at some sort of fundamental level to saying, no, actually, we're now part of it? And is there that big shift going on? And it's really interesting that different cultures are approaching it in different ways.
Yeah, I do feel there is a shift. And some years ago, Shane, I had the chance to go and spend some time on a study tour in the US. And I came back describing, in my the best way I could say it, a sea change was coming, and there is a very strong and developing part of ecology which is called socio-ecology. Now, how that might differentiate from aspects of geography, it's something that, you know, might be an interesting conversation to be had somewhere.
We had it last week.
Oh, you had that last week. There we go.
We had Richard Morgan on last week.
Oh, right. Oh, good. Well, I know Richard well. Yeah, so the essence that you say about social ecology bringing people into the system and that merging of what we might call different subject areas, but actually in terms of whether we call it geography or social ecology, but the recognition is that people are part of the system. I talked to the students about a play on words of two separate words, a part of the system, one word apart from the system. So a lot of the writings that may have come out of the colonization, the Christian ethic of apart, one word, from the system is with the sustainability debate and resilience debate and adaptation and to what extent we adapt or prevent is and coming through particularly from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which was started off in 2000, is that there is more move towards a play on words of a part of the system, two words, a part of the system.
And is this where science and politics start interacting at a very, very fundamental level when we start thinking about ways of seeing ourselves within the world and seeing our relationship to it and how you then express that by doing stuff in the world?
Well, I think so. And I mean, you know, again, we haven't got it strongly represented yet at the University of Otago, but the whole field of ecological economics, for example, is developing elsewhere in the world. There's certainly some very good work coming out of Lincoln University, looking at national accounting systems and different ways of doing things. So there is a lot of big thinking going on in the broad spectrum under the ecology umbrella.
Do you think, though, that we can describe the essence of the functioning ecosystem in terms that can be reduced to money?
In certain situations, I think we can. It's a tightrope that we walk, of course, because what economic value does one put on beauty? What economic value does one put on spiritual enrichment? What economic value do we put on a Cromwell chafer beetle, which is found just in a few hectares around, obviously around Cromwell. And the value of a species, what we can do is, in terms of what we term ecosystem services, is that, for example, we can look at the value of the economic value of water. So the economic value of water, how much gets into the streams, how much then gets into the rivers. If that water is to be used for hydroelectric purposes, how much fills the dams. If that water is to be used for irrigation purposes, how much it doesn't get into the dams and how much is in the irrigation. If the weather's really hot and dry, how much of the irrigation of the water actually evaporates before it ever reached the ground? What kind of vegetation should we have in catchments to maximise the capture of water, to maximise the amount that gets into the groundwater that then gets into the streams? I've done some work on this with colleagues of mine in this country and also elsewhere in the world, and it's very clear that certain vegetation types and certain plant species are very thirsty for water, and not so much water gets into the groundwater. They might have value for carbon sequestration, but they're thirsty for water. There's certain life plant life forms which are excellent at capturing water. Our tall tussock grasslands and grasses are the prime example of that. And we could say, okay, is this only in New Zealand? No, it's not. These tall tussock life forms are really important in countries in South America. We've got colleagues working in other parts of the world, in South Africa, China, etc., who are recognising now that different land covers, vegetation covers, are really, really important in terms of capturing water.
Do ecosystems or communities have inherent value? We seem to have accepted it that they do in terms of species, particularly the charismatic megafauna, that we're saving the panda just because.
Right.
It's quite cute.
Well, I mean, if you want to translate this, I mean, the usually wetlands are brought forward. If we look at wetlands as a community and if we look at them as a system, ecosystem. So if you look at wetlands broadly, what do they do? Well, they've often got a lot of organic matter, so there's a lot of carbon stored in the wetlands, often holding a lot of water, which is released fairly slowly, depending on the nature of the substrate. They can often be used as, well, in certain situations, they're used to sort of filter sewage in certain parts of the world. And so you can have systems which actually have very, very useful functions in working for and with people, communities, as well as functioning systems which may attract, wetlands attract bird life very often.
Does the emphasis on financial, you know, services or the services that nature gives to humanity, does that inadvertently reinforce the message that nature's there for us to exploit? Or do we have to be very, very careful about that? I mean, our relationship with nature, you know, are we inadvertently trying to fit in with the current paradigm, or do you want to shift the way people think about our relationship with nature? And is that the role of the ecologist?
Well,
there's two or three questions there.
Two or three questions there. What came into my mind when you were talking there, Shane, is that, I mean, again, ecologists are a diverse group of people, and they approach the subject area in different ways at different scales, etc. But if we take it, if we go back some time to James Lovelock's seminal work on looking at the planet as an entire system, and it brought through the terminology of Gaia. Now, if you look at the whole planet as a system, and if people try and understand. And I think certainly when the first moon landing occurred and you could look back at the Earth, that was a seminal time for us as humanity of saying, right, okay, one planet, set of people here, that we better try and understand this. Now, it's all very well to say that. What ecologists might want to do, and certainly spend a lot of time talking about it, is how to become more integrated with policy, with economic instruments, and politics, perhaps, also.
My favourite definition of sustainability, which listeners have heard me say lots of times, is that it's ethics extended in time and space.
Mm.
So I've got two questions. What can ecology tell us about scale? And the second one is going to be about the ethics of ecology. So
right.
Start with scale.
Okay, start with scale. Well, it's interesting you should say that, because it's one of the mantras that we drum in terms of undergraduate students, in terms of the importance of scale. So whether we're looking at a time scale or spatial scale, that understanding, getting an understanding of what might happen, I've given examples before. If we want to understand, for example, an individual kauri tree which is suffering dieback, and we find out that it's Phytophthora, which is a fungal infestation, perhaps, then our focus would be on the ecology of that kauri tree. If, however, we want to understand why we've got in the marine environment an algal bloom, we might want to understand what's happening in the catchment, which then feeds into the river, which then feeds out onto the coastline and perhaps has downstream effects. So I think the importance of scale is to be very, very aware of, well, in the science sense, we talk about what question are you asking, what are the objectives of the study. So you have to match the question, or match the issue, or match the observation, whatever level that you're looking at it, to the particular scale. So there's not one scale that fits every problem.
Secondly, then, there's a question of ethics. Does ecology have an inherent ethics?
That's an interesting question. I think each ecologist probably would say they operate on ethical grounds, which certainly in the academic environment would be associated with, in this country, the Royal Society of New Zealand has a code of ethics, if you like. In terms of ethical practice and in terms of what we introduce the students into in education, then I'm very pleased to say that our philosophy department at the university have just started an environmental ethics course, which I hope an increasing number of students will avail themselves of taking that, which will be bringing in the nuances of the debate between incorporating not just ecology, but, you know, the broader spectrum of consideration of the ethical environment in which we work.
Does it come with an inherent care? Do you have to care to be an ecologist?
Care about the environment? Care?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. No. If you are someone who is fascinated by complexity, fascinated by the interactions, you might be a mathematician by background and become absolutely fascinated by this intricacy of seeing how whether these interactions can be explained mathematically. And there are some mathematical ecologists out there, very good ones.
So how does ecology sit with sustainability?
I think it's a continuum. It's a continuum, so that some ecologists would be very, very concerned about sustainability, adaptation, resilience, and there's other ecologists where it's not part of the vocabulary in terms of the practice that they might do. Whether they actually subscribe or are concerned about it, that would be a broader philosophical debate with them, I suppose. Yeah.
Should every high school student come out with some sort of ecological literacy?
We use the word now in terms of graduate attributes at the University of Otago of environmental literacy. I think I'm just pausing there because it's about as humanity becomes increasingly urbanized, the connection to nature becomes more distant. And there's a lot of concern over how we might sort of say a connection with nature. Now, one of my colleagues in the geography department, along with another of my colleagues in the zoology department, have been doing some fascinating work on children and their connection with nature in urban situations. And so rather than saying ecological literacy, it would be it's more words, but I would say an appreciation of natural history, or we could say a positive relationship with nature, perhaps, rather than perhaps a fear. Fear can, distance or unfamiliarity with certain systems can lead to fears. It would be a sad day if people were fearful of being in a native forest or enjoying a rushing river or hearing a bird call.
What are the biggest changes that we should be worried about from your perspective?
In New Zealand or...
Globally.
Globally. Well, of course, there's the biggie with respect to climate change, but many will say that, again, we're coming back to scale. One of the more very rapid transformations are happening in terms of land cover change. And land cover change through the Americas, land cover change through the Indonesian archipelago, land cover change, I mean, you know, we've been experiencing it in New Zealand with a very rapid change shift to dairying, for example. I don't want to leave out the oceans. I mean, out of sight, out of mind. There's a lot of change going on within the oceans, which are much less visible. And so the rapidity of that change, for some, is of more immediate. I'm not saying that climate and what comes with the complexity of climate change is not to be concerned about at all, but there's some very rapid phase shifts, as we call it in ecology, associated with systems around the world that are going to be a bit like that spider's web analogy. It's easy to destroy a spider's web, but try building it back up again takes a bit of time, and even if it's possible.
How far are we from understanding those sorts of things and being able to predict them?
How far are we? Well, we're a lot further on than we were 5 years ago. That's not much of an answer, perhaps. But the situation is that we do have, as I referred to, some of the sophisticated modelling to help us be predictive, bearing with the caveat that we need to be aware of the robustness of the data that goes into these models, and we need to be aware of how we interpret these models. But they're there as a guide. Now, there's several elephants in the room that we have to take into account. One is the history. So I'm talking about history in terms of, in New Zealand sense, what might be over decades or centuries, but also evolutionary history. And very often, well, the elephant in the room, as I call it, is that we very often don't know that. So what we see is what we can measure in front of us, and we've got the data, and maybe our data sets are 20, 30 years of data, if we're lucky. Some of the odd one goes for longer than that, but not many. And we have to factor in the evolutionary history, the more recent history. The other elephants in the room are, of course, market forces, and how particular decisions, you might want to have sustainable land practices on your own property, for example, and you might be say you're in at the end of lower parts of the catchment or the mid parts of the catchment, and you're doing as well as you possibly can, but someone further up the catchment has very different practices, and literally there's a downstream effect. So if we're going to manage these systems, then it really does come back to a lot of it to integrate on land, integrated land policy. Years ago, before I ever arrived in New Zealand, there used to exist soil and water catchment boards. And there was the essence of looking at the system, you know, using the catchment boundaries and managing the system for its soil and vegetation and water. So that was in, I think, the 1950s through the 1960s. Maybe even
through to 89.
Through to 89.
I think it was 89. Yeah. We had Murray Harris on, who was for a while the Chief Soil Conservator. We'd better push on. Some questions to finish with. Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
An activist, if you think about it, is someone out there with the board saying no to nuclear power, or things of that ilk. No, I don't consider myself an activist, but there are people who are obviously activists in the sense of being proactive, of caring about whether it's a hydroelectric dam or dirty rivers, or you know, the quality of our soils. But as a scientist in the scientific community, that it's a tightrope over maintaining credibility as a scientist and being out there wanting to make a difference, and how you actually endeavour to make a difference.
What motivates you?
Well, it comes down to, I think I just said, elements of making a difference. Also, some years ago, I gave a public lecture which was called Diversity, the Spice of Life. And from one of the basis of that came from hearing someone quote another person, I think from Stanford University in the States, saying that if you have a complex problem or you have a difficult problem and you want to really make a difference over how you might address that, and you collect a bunch of people together in a room, and it's not the collective IQ that you have in the room, it's the diversity that you have in the room. And for me, there's a real motivation there, is that in terms of listening to different perspectives and valuing perspectives, which isn't to walk away from the fact that decisions can be difficult to make, not everybody might agree, but that that diversity is that the chances are that that diversity will lead to a more robust outcome. And if you want to make a difference, then maybe that's a good way at least to give some time to.
Okay, nice and quickly so we don't get in trouble and overrun the Buddhists. What challenges do you have in the next couple of years?
Next couple of years? We're thinking about some new courses to offer in ecology, so there's some good challenges there. There's some interesting challenges with respect to the university environment, and you know, the nature of funding and science funding within this country. So if we're looking at it, it doesn't just affect ecology and ecologists, but science funding and the challenges associated with science funding. And in fact, there's called some science challenges, and we hope to see some funding come through that.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, what would it be?
Oh, gosh, world peace. well, you did ask some. Right, yeah. What would happen in, well, in the New Zealand context, I would say a lot more money for science. And at the start, what I might say is that for this country, in the science arena and the ecology arena, a bunch of postdoctoral fellowships on offer, where it gives the opportunity for a range of very, very talented, smart, keen, enthusiastic young scientists to actually have a go in this country. There's not many postdoctoral opportunities here. They're hard to come by. It's hard to get the funding for them. You often get overheads associated with them.
Is there a single big question that all those people would do, or is it a scattergun?
Well, it could, depending on the design of you, of that wand, we could design it so that these postdoctoral fellowships were related to work on some big questions which were complementary.
And lastly, do you have any advice for listeners?
Yes, you can. As individuals, we can all make a difference. And I come back to the work that I talked about with our garden study. That is, the research in the last few years has been some of my most enjoyable, not just with the people I'm working with, but the householders who we've come to work with. And there's just a lot of inspiration out there. The amount of biodiversity in your gardens and the relationship with the gardens is can make a real difference. And whether it's a bucket or a window box, or you do have a block of earth, then there's a lot that you can do in your backyard.
Well, that's awesome. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio 105.4 FM, because we've run out of time. And we hope you enjoyed our show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.